Advisement. Move on to the next case, which is United States versus Espinoza. Mr. Mose?
May it please the court, good morning. Obviously, the threshold issue in this case is whether this court lacks jurisdiction for the untimely filing of the notice of appeal. And I think it requires initially looking at the record and how the court explained to Mr. Espinoza his appellate rights. The court was following, clearly followed Rule 32C5 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure and explaining to him that if you so request, the court clerk will prepare a notice of appeal for you. But it came in a rather confusing way because it was formed in a compound question. The court explained to him that and then additionally stated to him, if you would like, Ms. Gentle, your appointed attorney at sentencing and trial can be reappointed for appeal. And then said to him, is that what you wish to do? And he said, yes. And I think that's where the confusion on the part of his counsel, Ms. Gentle, and on the defendant himself came from, that he clearly was exhibiting an intent to perfect the appeal through the clerk having the notice of appeal filed, as well as have Ms. Gentle reappointed to handle his appeal. This court has recognized in an opinion of U.S. versus Hirsch, which came out in 2000, a similar circumstance. The attorney in that situation claimed the same mistake, the mistaken belief that the clerk would file the notice of appeal as his excusable neglect or good cause under 4B to demonstrate that he should be able to file the notice of appeal out of time. The difference in that situation was that he did not utilize the time period, the 10-day time period under 4B for filing the notice of appeal, as well as the additional 30-day extension that's permitted under that rule. He essentially dragged his feet for well over 100 days before checking the docket to see whether an appeal had been filed, and then at that point took some action to attempt to get the notice of appeal filed and perfect the appeal. The court did note in that case that had the clerk not performed the ministerial act of filing the notice of appeal upon the request of the defendant, that would constitute good cause under 4B4.
I'm going to say the bottom line of your position, because I hate for you to use the whole 10 minutes on this, is that the district court didn't abuse its discretion in finding excusable neglect, because the reason why the notice of appeal wasn't filed initially on time arose from the ambiguity of the district judge's statement and some good faith mistakes about what was going to happen, what wasn't going to happen, which apparently even the district judge shared, given his denial of the initial motion for permission to file out of time, you know, for an extension.
Correct.
Maybe, unless there's...
No, I was going to say a very short time. I think the tough issue here is the merits of the denial of the safety valve.
I'll move right on to that. The issue on the merits is the application of the safety valve to my client's case in sentencing. I think it requires a close look at the statute 3553F5. Which states that you essentially have to make full disclosure to the government of all information or evidence that you have concerning the offense or offenses that were part of the same course or conduct or of a common scheme or plan. And this specific language hasn't been, the legislative history on the statute, Congress has given no guidance as to what it meant by that language. At least one case, U.S. versus Gambino, which is a Second Circuit case from 1997, looked to 1B1.3 of the sentencing guidelines for definitions of common scheme or plan or course of conduct, and essentially found that you have to find some, at least some substantial connection among the things that you're talking about. And
Mr. Mose, if we zero in on these telephone calls that were coming in on the cell phone, the district judge believed the statement, well, in this proper statement, which is attached to your brief, paragraph 13, reports Espinoza stated he was scared and instructed the caller covertly that he had been arrested. If the district judge thought that was what was going on, and that in these calls where he supposedly didn't know Claudia and some of the other, I guess there was one call where he switches back and forth from Spanish to English, and I inferred that the agent was not a Spanish speaker, or maybe he was, I don't know, but if the district judge believed that Espinoza was trying to throw them off the track there, isn't that enough to support a finding that the safety valve isn't required?
I would reluctantly concede that yes, that would be enough, but I would say that viewed in the totality of the circumstances, nothing was held against Mr. Espinoza or Mr. Alvarado when they came into custody and were essentially eviscerating about what happened. They changed their story several times. They denied being in possession of the cocaine, knowing about it, and when confronted with their inconsistencies, they bit by bit began to come out with their story. Obviously, they were scared. They didn't have counsel representing them. They didn't know what to do, and bit by bit, their story came out. But I think, viewed in the totality of the circumstances, that he made a good faith effort to provide them with all the information that he knew, and I think the crux of the telephone calls is, if the proffer is to be believed in terms of the statement that he did state, I did, in fact, inform her in Spanish that we had been arrested and terminated the phone call, that when you view that in the totality of the circumstances, Mr. Espinoza provided the government with an abundance of information.
So the government argues that that may well have been an important reason why Mr. Vallejo slipped the noose. I mean, they never got the trail car, did they?
No, they didn't.
Yeah.
He was arrested. They were taken into custody. They were interrogated. And story switched, and by the time the information finally started coming out and they noticed that the cell phone calls were coming in, I find it very hard to believe that the trail car, at some point in time, I assume the trail cars keep up with the car that they're following and maintain their course, mm-hmm. that even if he had been able to identify who Claudia was, and I think it's reasonable to assume she was the woman identified as the three that were in the trail car, that they would have been able to find the trail car. They could have left back to Texas. They could have continued on to here where the alleged destination was or anywhere else. So if he didn't know her identity, under the safety valve, under this fifth prong of the safety valve provision, that can't be held against him. If he doesn't have any further information, he can't correct it. He made a mistake in terminating the phone call and telling them that and telling her that they had been arrested, but how does he correct that thereafter once he finds out that he might be applicable to the safety valve provision? He provided him by his name, his description, where they met, the phone calls, the phone numbers where they transacted business, the person that introduced them, that person's address, where they made the pickup, the description of the person that gave them the narcotics, their course of travel, running into the trail car people and identifying them at least by description, and two of them by name, one being Mr. Vallejo, when they ran into him in a restaurant in Oklahoma, a description of Mr. Vallejo's car. He supplied them an abundance of information, in my opinion, that I think would entitle him to the provisions of the safety valve provision. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Thanks. Ms. DuBoro?
May it please the Court, Counsel. Deirdre Durbro, Assistant United States Attorney from the Southern District of Illinois. With all due respect, Your Honors, I don't believe this is a Hirsch situation where mistakenly the clerk did not file the notice of appeal. I think it's clear from the record that the court was simply reappointing the lawyer, that there may in fact be an appeal to discuss whether or not there should be an appeal with the defendant.
Clearly he has a right to an appeal, right?
Pardon?
He obviously has a right to an appeal.
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
Sooner or later he's going to get an appeal.
If he files a notice, yes, sir.
The thing that I have trouble with is your, and I think that's where Judge Mannion's going, is the fact that maybe we get there because if the lawyer really blew it, then that's ineffectiveness of counsel. And after 2255, we say, yes, that was ineffectiveness of counsel, go back, file the notice of appeal, the notice of appeal is filed, and here we are again, you know, on the safety valve. But it seems, I don't find anything clear about this statement from the court, because the transcript shows the court saying two things. If you request, the clerk of the court will prepare a notice of appeal on your behalf. Now, if that's all he had said, and Mr. Espinoza had said, yes, Your Honor, then I think everyone would reasonably have thought that the clerk was going to do that, and it would have been done in time, etc. Instead, he goes on and he also says, if you request, I can reappoint Ms. Gentle right now to handle an appeal on your behalf. Okay, would you like me to do that? He says, after the two sentences, Mr. Espinoza says, yes, Your Honor. And he responds with a statement about Ms. Gentle. Ms. Gentle, I reappoint you. But he's not the clerk of the court. And so I find it quite ambiguous about whether it was excusable for the lawyer to think that that had been taken care of. And she was certainly monitoring the situation, because it's only 2 days after it should have been filed that she discovers that there's a problem. She, unlike the district court, immediately comes in with the motion for the extension of time based on excusable neglect, and the district court still gets it wrong. The district court says it's not necessary. So there's a lot of blame here to be placed on the court, such that I think all in all, it would be hard to say that it was an abuse of discretion for the later district judge to say, okay, excusable neglect exists here, let's grant the motion for the extension, let the appeal go forward.
I, as well as this court, would probably love to immediately get to the merits of this case, because I think it is a winner for the government. I don't think the defendant can prove that the district court committed clear error in its findings. I do agree that there is ambiguity in what the district court said. However, I have frequently heard it phrased similarly like that, and I don't take that to mean that that they're filing the appeal. Quite frankly, I found it odd that she did in fact file the appeal if she truly believed that it had already been filed.
She probably called to find out if it was there. That would be one reason why she did what she did 2 days later. Discovered to her horror that it wasn't, and immediately comes in and tries to address the situation. So maybe you should address the merits, because I mean, you certainly have briefed this issue and we can consider it.
As to the merits of this case, the court made its determination based upon credibility of the witnesses, and that included the credibility of the defendant. And I think that if you look at the judge's credibility determinations, you cannot find that they're clearly erroneous. Clearly, the court listened to all the evidence, which included the proffers. He reviewed those and found that the defendant simply was not believable in several instances, and simply cited three instances where he found his disbelief, that being the involvement with the 1995 drug case, denying talking with any of the cellmates, even though all of these cellmates knew, you know, intimate details of the arrest, and finally the whole cell phone call. So I think the court used those as examples that showed that clearly the defendant had not cooperated at its proffer. And certainly, even at the time of sentencing, it's too late to begin the cooperation, but did not do it there. Simply recited some of the same facts that he had recited when arrested. So I don't think this court should overturn the court's ruling, because it was based upon credibility determinations of the defendant as well as the government's witnesses, and therefore you should, if you find that jurisdiction does exist and there was in fact excusable neglect, that the sentence of the defendant should be affirmed. Are there any other questions?
Apparently not. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Moe? All right, well, if you have time, you got a minute, but you don't have to use it.
In terms of the lack of jurisdiction or jurisdiction thereof, I would concur with you that obviously there's no record before you, but I work with Ms. Gentle exactly what she did. She believed that the clerk had filed the notice of appeal. She checked when she found out it hadn't been done. She immediately took action to remedy the situation, which I believe in the Hirsch case, makes it different than the attorney in that case. And therefore, her actions, I believe, fall under the excusable neglect situation, and therefore this court has jurisdiction to hear the appeal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks very much. The case will be taken under advisement.